Okay, there. I think it's working. There we go. Okay, Ezekiel chapter 47. So, as you look at that, yes. So, actually, let's go to 46 because I want to talk a little bit about 46, and then we'll move on to 47. Last week, remember, and I told you, we're just sort of skimming over the last several chapters. I encourage you to read them. They talk about the millennial temple, and we spent a lot of time talking about that last week. So, and the reestablishment of that, and also the reestablishment of even some of the sacrificial system, but it would be for a different purpose than what it was initially for. But one thing that's true, I was thinking about this after we met last week, I don't know if I made this clear. One thing that is true, it has always been God's intent that giving of sacrifices was not what made people right. Because even in the Old Testament, you remember that it wasn't just merely killing an animal and shedding its blood. The heart had to be right along with that. You know, it's not just a matter of, and if you think about that in the Old Testament, the heart having to be right, it really brings you to the place of the ultimate sacrifice, who is Jesus. Because many people have died and many people were crucified and stuff, but everything else had to be right for that sacrifice to be acceptable to God. Okay? So even in the Old Testament, it's not merely the killing of animals or the shedding of blood and stuff. And that's true even for Jesus. None of us could have died in Jesus' place. No man could have died in Jesus' place. So it's not merely the shedding of blood. There's other things that have to be involved in it. And even when we come to the millennial temple, they again will have sacrifices there that are offered up to God, but they're not offered up for atonement or redemption. That's done. But they again are from a right heart and acknowledgement to God for all that He has accomplished for His people. Okay? So, when you, in chapter 46, look at verse 3, and we'll read just a few verses here, give you a taste of what he's talking about here. He says, likewise, the people of the land shall worship at the entrance of this gateway, talking about the gateway of the temple again, before the Lord on the Sabbath and the new moons. Again, this very clearly tells you that the emphasis in the millennium will be, Messiah will be where? It'll be in Israel. All the practices will have clearly a, how do I say it, a Jewish, big Jewish flavor. You know, not the Western church flavor that we have today and stuff. In other words, you're going to go back to that. The Old Testament gives us, there's all sorts of arguments today about worship and styles of worship and all this kind of stuff that goes on in our churches and stuff. But God gives clarity in the acts of worship in the Old Testament. You know, and as he brings this about, it's going to come back again. Will there be Gentiles here? Of course there will be Gentiles here. But you're going to have the people in the land in the presence of Messiah and worshiping him as God intended. And notice that, again, he talks about Sabbath and he talks about new moons. There's nothing about Sabbaths and new moons for us in the church. We don't have those feasts and festivals. You understand what I'm saying? We don't have a Sabbath day. For the church, clearly the writer of Hebrews tells us that our Sabbath is a person. It's Jesus. We rest in Him all the time. That to me is one of the identifying things of the church that distinguishes us from Israel, is that Christ is our Sabbath, you know, and we don't have that day. But it talks about, again, these things that the Jewish mindset would understand, that actually we Gentiles have no real thought. Verse 4 says, the burnt offerings that the prince offers to the Lord on the Sabbath day shall be 6 lambs without blemish, a ram without blemish, the grain offering, those will be offered. Verse 6, on the day of the new moon it shall be a young bull. So again, he's given them instructions of the offerings along with the worship that will take place during that time. It talks about the prince, it talks about Messiah, you know, and again, he doesn't use the word Messiah, he actually uses the word prince here. But who will be the leader here? The leader here will be the Lord. He will be in control. He will be leading. Elsewhere in the Old Testament prophets, it talks about that during that 1,000-year reign, Isaiah says that he will rule with a rod of iron. In other words, the point there is that whatever he says will be. And it will be perfect. It's not this matter. I don't think it's this matter of he's going to have a rod of iron in his hand beating people on the head if they don't do what he wants to say. It just means he will be that term means he will be the ultimate authority. His word will be what is. And so even during this time, there will be this millennial temple. There will be the sacrifices. There will be the worship. There will be all of these things. And it again will be, as we talked about last week, it will be, in that day, it will be as it always should have been. It will be as it always should have been. Perfect. So when you look at that millennial temple, those are some of the things that it talks about there. Now we go to chapter 47. And he's going to describe something very interesting, which comes very close to what John even talks about some in the book of Revelation. But here's what he says. He said, "Then he brought me back to the door of the temple, and there was water flowing from under the threshold of the temple toward the east and the front of the temple faced east." And we talked about that as we drew the temple that faced east, okay? "The water flowing under the right side of the temple, south of the altar. He brought me out of the way of the north gate and led me around the outside of the outer gate that faces east, and there was water running on the right side." Now, a couple pictures here. Psalm 1, you remember Psalm chapter 1, what's it talk about? To be planted by the river, okay? Isaiah talks about streams in the desert, okay? Isaiah talks about a fountain that cannot be quenched and stuff. John talks about the rivers that flow from that place and stuff. What is the water in each one of those things represent? The water clearly would represent life. It would represent truth. Paul says in Ephesians chapter 5, he talks that we are washed with the water of the word. Water speaks of purity. You know, how many times do you see the mikvahs, which are the Jewish baths, where the priest would wash himself and cleanse himself? So it speaks of purity. It talks about that which it represents for us, that which God gives to His people. When we think about water, especially we who are in the desert, we think of refreshment, life. I neglected to water my plants out front for the last 2 days in this 113 day, and in 2 days, you know what I'm talking about. You know, and so, but you put a little water on them, you wake up in the morning, and they're, desert plants are interesting things, so. So, when he talks about that, he talks about the water, but in verse 4, he again talks about not just water, but clearly an abundance of water. And again, the representation of that in the desert place, an abundance of water in the desert place, speaks of God's supply. I want you to see that God has a promise that in the millennium, He's going to supply. He's going to be the people's supply. They're not going to have need. They're not going to have want. And how's that going to touch them? I think it's going to touch them in a lot of ways. I think it's going to touch them in physical healing. Certainly going to touch them in their spiritual walk, in their emotional walk, all the things that we lack so much in this sin-fallen world. He is going to be their supply. Does that mean there's not going to be any problems during that time? Remember, they're still human. They're still in the flesh. They're still having to it's not going to be, as I read it, it's not going to be fully like it was in Eden. In Eden, what was Eden like? Perfect. I mean, no hunger, no thirst, no sickness, actually no death, you know. And what's going to happen in the millennium, apparently, according to what Isaiah says and what Ezekiel says here, that it's going to move back toward an Eden-type setting, but you still have to remember the world has been still touched by sin. So will there be death in the millennium? I think there will be. But Isaiah says that if a man dies at 100 years during that time, it would be as like an infant dying. It would be an unusual thing is the point there. So things are going to change. I guess to a lot of people what they would see is the environment would be probably closer to like pre-flood environment where people lived for a lot of years and stuff, while not going all the way back to Eden, because this earth has been touched by sin, and even in the millennium, though things will be changed, the earth still will suffer corruption until the end when he will destroy it by fire. Does everybody get that picture there? Because I don't think the Bible teaches in any of the prophets that you're going to have an Eden-type setting, completely Eden-type. I don't know that we can. I guess our Eden-type setting will be heaven. You know, but definitely there will be such a change in the environment and even the bodies of people and their ability to live a long amount of time, and that God will supply everything that they need, including healing, which is kind of wonderful to consider. Questions or comments on that?
Is that where the saints rule and reign during the millennium?
Yes. Yeah. But again, let's think about this. This temple is, and what's going to be here will be for those who are here on earth. So these people have gone through studies of Revelation. They have gone through the tribulation period, where as much as 2/3 of the people on earth are dead, which also would include close to 2/3 of Israel, gone. And then you have the remnant, who at the end of the tribulation period, according to the prophet, sees Christ when he comes. Says that they will see him who they pierced, and then they will believe. Okay. Prior to that happens, we talked about a couple of weeks ago, you will already have had the midway point of abomination, desolation, and the people will say, Antichrist certainly cannot be Messiah. So he will try to destroy them for the last 3.5 years. And when we come to the last part of that, it looks like he's about ready to destroy them, and then you have Jesus returning. And they will know him as their Messiah. From there you have Antichrist, false prophet, cast into the lake of fire immediately. Then you have the destructions of the nations at that time that are standing against God's people. He will destroy them. He says with the word that comes out of his mouth, he'll destroy them. But you will have people who will be left, not only Jews, but Gentiles also, who will go into the millennial reign. And for 1,000 years, Jesus will rule and reign. And we've talked about this. Does that mean that everybody will be believers in the millennium? I don't know. Because remember what happens to Satan. He will be bound for that 1,000 years, cast into the abyss for 1,000 years, and then he will be released. And when he's released, then he will lead a rebellion. The nations will follow him against Christ, which is kind of nutty if you think about it. But they will follow him, and then they will be destroyed, and from there we'll enter into eternity. Okay, but during that millennial reign, the question is, where will we be? Well, we will not be in these bodies. We will not be here. We will have received our glorified body. Will we be able to be here on earth? I think we will. I think the Bible talks about ruling and reigning with Christ and being here. So, you know, in my kid-like mind, I'm thinking, where's that? We're zipping all over the, you know, the universe, you know, and it's pretty cool. So, but. There are two distinct groups there. There are the bride of Christ or the church that we call them, and we will have our glorified bodies, but we will have access to here, clearly. So it's going to be quite an interesting thing. So.
Is this kind of maybe where
they don't know what you can get this new earth during the process? It's exactly where they get it. And they talk about, they see, the Jehovah's Witnesses see a renewed earth. Okay, and they distinguish two groups, you know, the 144,000 and the rest of us, and basically they believe, now the Jehovah's Witnesses don't believe in hell, what they believe is annihilation. So you actually have three groups. You have the 144,000 chosen who will get to go to heaven. You have the rest of us who will spend eternity on a renewed earth. And that's what they're always trying to present you with, that they're not telling you can be one of the 144,000, they want you to know that you can be a part of the renewed earth group. But for the third group, for them, is that they will be annihilated. They believe in annihilation of the soul. So if you don't go to heaven and you don't get to spend eternity on here on earth, you just are zapped into nothingness. Okay. By the way, most cults do teach annihilation of the soul. They don't teach hell. So.
Well, that is a hell in its own way, because if you're out there by yourself, wherever you...
No, you're not. You're gone. You're zapped.
That's what I mean.
No consciousness.
Oh, there's nothing left.
There's nothing. You just cease to exist completely.
Well, I hope I'll be the one to go to heaven.
Yeah. That's what Jesus said.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the difference between even stepping into, some people talk about hell as being a place of nothingness, outer darkness, or that it talks about and stuff like that, torment and stuff, but complete consciousness, which is what the Bible actually teaches, complete consciousness. But these groups like Jehovah's Witness say you just cease to be completely. So you don't know anything because you're not there anymore. You know? So that's what they teach. Okay? So when we look at this, we see this promise. I hope you see this in chapter 47, this promise of provision. Not only just provision, but abundant provision, as it describes the size, you know, when it talks about the size of the river and the things it does, you know, the trees on the bank, and it just represents life and newness and provision that God has for those who are His. Now, starting in verse 13 in chapter 47, we have the boundaries of the land that were given to, that are going to be given to the people. Now, never since the beginning of the covenant promise has Israel dwelt in the land in the fullness of the boundaries that God promised. Okay? Abraham never did, Isaac never did, Jacob never did, David never did. Probably, you know, you might even say under David the kingdom was as big as it was going to be, you know. And clearly today they're not, clearly today they're just in this little, that's someone practicing their saxophone, okay? This little strip of land. So what are the boundaries that he has said that will be? In other words, they will be, I want you to get the millennium is the fulfillment of God's covenant promise to Abraham. Because they will be in the land just as God says. And the land will be just as God said the land will be during that time. So let's look at verse 13. It says, "Thus saith the Lord, these are the borders by which you shall divide land as an inheritance among the 12 tribes of Israel. Joseph shall have two portions." Okay? So here again you have, you know this is not between the exile, you know, what we call Daniel's exile, that's what I'm just labeling it, and the coming of Christ, because they never got back in the land this way. For 2,000 years, they haven't been back in the land this way. They're not back in the land this way today. And by the way, most of the tribes are unidentifiable, and what I mean by that is that they haven't divided the land up according to tribal portions today. It's just Israel. Okay, so he goes on to say, verse 14, "You shall inherit it equally with one another, for I lifted my hand in an oath to give it to your fathers, and this land shall be as to you your inheritance." Now, who's the fathers that he said he would do this to? Abraham first, Isaac next, which is important because you have Isaac and who? Esau, the two brothers. But what did he say? He said, "I'm going to give it to Abraham. From Abraham, I'm not going to give it to Ishmael. I'm going to give it to Isaac, the son of promise." Isaac had two sons, which is Esau and Jacob. And he said, "But I'm not giving it to Jacob. I'm not giving it to Esau. I'm giving it to Jacob, and his name is Israel." And from there, to the 12 sons. Okay? And so when he says, "This is the land that I promised to your fathers," those are the fathers he's talking about. I would say it starts with Abraham and goes all the way through the 12 sons of Jacob. They are the patriarchs. They are the heads of the family. And remember, when God called Abraham, there was no nation Israel. There were no Jewish people. Okay? He established them. He birthed a nation from where there was no nation. And he gives a clear distinction as to who the covenant falls on in every generation. That's crucial. Because that's what the fight's over even today. You know? We're studying Islam on Sunday night right now, and one of the things is that the Muslim people believe that the son of promise was Ishmael. Now that changes everything. If your view is that Ishmael is the son of promise instead of Isaac, does that not change everything in your view of who owns the land or who should possess the land? Of course it does. And so we kind of say, well, why? How do they think that way? Well, they think that way because that's what they've been taught. That's what they believe. In the same way that the Jews believe that Isaac is the son of promise. And not only the Jews, but biblical Christians believe that also because we have the word that tells us that.
Well, why did they believe it? Perhaps because Ishmael was the firstborn of Abraham? That Ishmael, you know, the
yeah, yeah. And he actually is the father of the Arab nations. You know, but and God even spoke to him. And God did give a promise to Ishmael and to Hagar. But it had nothing to do with the land. Okay? So, yeah, as you read back there in Genesis, you see God did give a promise to Ishmael. It wasn't a pleasing one, because you'll be a wild donkey and nobody's going to like you and type thing. But God makes that distinction. I mean, the word does not leave it where you say, well, it could be Ishmael or it could be Isaac. No, it's very clear. The next generation after Abraham, it's Isaac. And then it could be Jacob or it could be Esau. Well, no, it can't. You know, it's Jacob.
That's our God, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Not the other one.
Yeah. So, when we see, so he said he's going to, the land promised the fathers, that is the fulfillment of the covenant. Okay? And again, I want to remind you, the land covenant has to do with Israel, has nothing to do with you. We've never been promised a land. The only land we've been promised is heaven. That's our home. And that's our covenant. Okay? A home in heaven. Verse 15, thus shall be the border of the land on the north from the great sea by the road of Hethon that goes to Zedad. What is a great sea there? It's a Mediterranean Sea. Okay? All right? So that's going to be the north. Thus the boundary shall be from the sea of Hazar Enan. And I don't know all these seas, so I'm sorry I don't have all this to you. The border of Damascus as of the north. Northward it is border of Hamath. Now we do know Damascus. Damascus today is in Syria. Okay? So you could see, I think you could probably see how even reading this in the presence of the Syrian people could cause
a little problem.
Little problem, yeah. Okay. On the east, you shall mark out the border between Haran and Damascus, and between Gilead and the land of Israel along the Jordan, along the eastern side, the sea. This is the east side. Now, what's going to bother you about that is that's going to take you into most of Jordan today. Okay. So again, what's that going to do? That could cause some issues. On the south side, toward the south, shall be from Tamar to the waters of Meribath, Kadesh, and the border, and the brook to the great sea. This is the south side toward the south. That's going to bother the Egyptians. And also Saudi Arabia today. Okay? And the west side shall be the great sea. You can't really go much west. Okay? But even going west can bother the Palestinians today. Because today the Palestinians hold for themselves pretty much, well, you can see it right here, below Joppa, this whole west side here, which is called the Gaza Strip today, is held by the Palestinians. Okay? So when you look at what is promised of the land, the millennial land for the tribes, okay, it is much bigger than what today is. And it actually engulfs some of these, many of these regions and stuff. Are there going to be conflict over this? Well, no, because the conflict actually is going to be taken care of in the last battle when Christ comes back again. Questions or comments? Input?
Do you think that's including most of Sinai?
Oh, I think almost all of Sinai.
Do you think it goes through over the river there in Egypt?
I don't know that it goes all the way to the Nile.
Yeah,
I think it goes down to where you will see that the Red Sea joins together down there, which would include all of Sinai.
All of Sinai.
Which is held by Egypt today.
Wasn't that land Israel held for a while?
Yes.
Oh
no, no.
No.
They didn't hold it.
Okay.
They were allowed. It was almost like a shared area.
Okay.
It was an uneasy peace in a shared area, but Egypt always claimed it as their own, and they allowed the Israelis to have certain things there. And if you go there today, we have some of our military are right out there in the middle of the desert. They have listening posts there. You'll drive right past them. You won't even know what you're driving right past and stuff. So it's, and I don't know who would want to live there. I don't even know who would want to own it. Talk about desolate. We go over there and the guys always say, well, you were used to this because you're from Arizona, that desert. And stuff. I said, no, our desert is pretty. You know, we actually have live things on our desert. You can drive for miles and see one little scrawny tree, you know, and they think that that's, you know, wow. Anyway, okay, verse 20, and thus you shall divide the land among yourself according to the tribes of Israel. It shall be that you will divide it by lot as an inheritance for yourself and for the strangers who sojourn among you and who bear children among you. So, though this land is there, notice what it's a different kind of land. It's an open land. It is a land without walls. And though there is a portion given to each of them, it's not here's my line, don't cross it. As a matter of fact, he actually says that the Gentile nations will be welcome during this time. Everybody got that?
What do the Jews think of the book of Ezekiel and all the poems, especially here at the end with the promises?
Well, I think they hold this very, very important that they're going to reestablish a misunderstood Zionist nation.
Okay, so this is going to be a war that's going to bring it about.
Yeah, they think they're going to bring it about. Okay. But even today, as you look at Israel, Israel is restricted by land. And so, you know, when you look at this, I just want you to see this. People don't understand the effect of what we're talking about. First of all, I remind you, Israel is the size of New Jersey. I remind you that means that 8 nations of Israel can fit in the state of Arizona. It kind of puts it in some perspective. Okay? All right. Within that, today, here's the Dead Sea. Here is the Sea of Galilee. Within that today, where's Nazareth at? There's an area that starts out here, goes all the way down. It's called the West Bank area. It's a huge area that goes all the way down to Jericho, okay, that takes a big chunk out of that little bit of land we just talked about. And then on this side, I already told you, the Gaza area, where the Palestinians, both these are Palestinian held places and stuff. So even within that small place, there's not much land that's just for Israel. If you go take a tour of Israel, you have to stop at checkpoints within Israel because you're about to cross into what they call occupied land. You go into Bethlehem, you've got to stop, and you actually have to change buses and go get on a Palestinian bus to go into Bethlehem. Okay, same thing now with Jericho. Sometimes they'll let them through with a regular bus to go up from the Dead Sea to the Sea of Galilee. But if they choose not to, then they have to go around. Okay? So, even today, the land is not as big. When someone says these are the borders of Israel, it's really, a lot of that is not Israeli. A lot of that is Palestinian held land and stuff. So, there is a premium on the land. That's why the settlements and all the disputes on the settlements and all these kind of things continue to go on. But notice the change in attitude. I want you to see the change in attitude here. It says, in this day, when the land is as God intended for it to be, the fullness of the land that God calls Israel, that he's divided among the 12, everybody's welcome. Everybody gets to be a part. And it's Israel's, because God has given it to Israel, and because Messiah is there, but nobody's, you know, it's not like this thing, get off my lawn type thing. It's hey, we're here, we're experiencing the fullness of the covenant that was given to our father Abraham, and all people are welcome. What a great place that will be. Talk about peace on earth, and you know, and again, some of our Christmas songs are actually millennial songs. Joy to the World is not a first Advent song. It's a second Advent song. When the King comes and when there will be peace on earth and all these promises and stuff. And he describes it here. Ezekiel describes it here in such a way. Can you imagine where strangers will come in and they'll actually bear children there? You know. So, I mean, go ahead.
I don't know how your translation reads. I've got the New Living. And that verse 22 and 23, they actually say the foreigners in the land will raise their families among you, and they will be like native-born.
Native-born, and they'll have an inheritance with you.
And they will receive an allotment among the tribes. Yeah, mine says, the foreigners are to be given land within the territory of the tribe with whom they now live.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah, it is a huge wow.
Yeah, really.
You know?
Okay.
I don't know if Israel recognizes that yet, as they study this.
No, they do not.
I don't think they think they're going to have the land their own.
Right. And it's a little bit, even when you think about our country and stuff, that, you know, that's a big dispute going on right now. We got closed borders and stuff like that, and I don't want to get political because I don't know what you feel about that stuff, but not only our country, but almost every country on earth has closed borders and stuff, and we're one of the few countries that if you're actually born on American soil, you're an American citizen. You can be born in some other countries, it doesn't matter. You know, if your parents are not of that citizenship, you're not considered a citizen of that. So it's going to be interesting. I guess the point is, God's going to fulfill his covenant with them, but that covenant's not only going to, the point is, the covenant's not only going to bless Israel, but it's going to bless all the nations of the world. You know, when the fulfillment of the land covenant is done here, all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed of God. Which, isn't that the way it's always supposed to be? Even for the church, when God blesses us, not so we can sit around and say, look how blessed I am, but God blesses us that we might be a blessing to other people. God pours something into your life, it's never just for you alone. That's called selfishness. Okay? God pours something in your life or my life. He gifts you. He gives you material things. It's so that we can be involved in the kingdom work. You know, it's kind of like, you know, you may get something with your left hand, and you need to let it go with your right hand. You know, it's just hoarding is not a Christian characteristic. You know, it's all mine. I'm going to get all I can and stuff. You know, you can't carry it with you, so what, you know, if you can see, if we can begin to see money or possessions or talents or anything as just wonderful tools of God that he's given us for the moment that we're here, people say, well, if I give this away, then I'm not going to have. God is able to do, just like Jesus said, he's able to take that little bit that we give away sometime and multiply it. You know, it's to me the economy of heaven is just it's an amazing thing, and that's what God intends. It's what God intends here, and it's going to come to pass here in the millennium, in practice. Okay, questions or comments? All right, chapter 48. He's going to give the divisions of the land here. These are the names of the tribes that he's going to give. Okay, and so. He's going to start up in the north by Damascus, and he begins with the tribes of Dan and Asher, which is interesting. You see, Dan is included here. If you go over to Revelation and you see the 144,000, Dan is not included in that list. Okay? There's all kinds of speculation to why. Dan was the one that led his fellows into idolatry. He's the one that, you know, but when you get into the millennium, he's back. Okay? He's back. So you have Dan, you have Asher, you have Naphtali, you have Manasseh, and then you have Ephraim. Manasseh and Ephraim, who are they? They're sons of Joseph, which speaks again what we found all the way back in the last chapter as a double portion. When it says that Joseph gets a double portion, he's talking about the tribes of Manasseh and Ephraim. Okay? And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, in Revelation, Joseph is actually named Well, let's look at that. Let's look at those 12 tribes. Revelation chapter, I should know that. 7, yeah. Chapter 7. Okay. Back in Revelation, here's a tribe that are Judah, Reuben, Gad, Asher, Naphtali, Manasseh, Simeon, Levi, Issachar, Zebulun, Joseph, and Benjamin. Who are missing? Dan is missing, and Ephraim is missing. Okay? So you have Joseph back in here. Okay, but remember when they went in the land, Joseph again was divided between Ephraim and Manasseh. Okay, and Dan is not in here. Okay, so Joseph actually took up two portions when it comes to these 144,000. I cannot even answer you why Dan was not there. It's all speculation. And most of it has to do with what they believe is that Dan was the tribe that led the rest of them into idolatry. And even today you go to where the tribe of Dan is and stuff, and up there it's the headwaters of the Jordan River, and they have gods up there for Pan and horrendous idolatry. So some people hold that to be the truth. Yes?
Oh, I was just saying that kind of came back in the book of Judges when you were saying that. And when that happened, and then Micah came from Ephraim, which was the...
Say it again.
Micah?
Yeah.
From Ephraim? I mean, there was a change that happened in the book of Judges there, where in some Bible interpretations they say Manasseh and some they say Moses. Because when there was the falling away, they couldn't believe that this person could be Moses' son. I think it was two generations later.
Yeah, exactly.
And so some of the, I guess, scribes couldn't bear to write that, so they changed Manasseh, I guess, in the way that the Greek writing was, or the Hebrew writing.
The Hebrew writing, yeah.
They changed that.
Yeah. There's a whole bunch of different things like that people say, is this? I don't know. You know, ultimately. The point is, when you come back here, he's going to reestablish these tribes as God said that he would. So we go on down. We have Naphtali. We have Manasseh. You can do a little count here as we go through this. Okay. Then we have the next one will be Reuben. Reuben is the eldest son. But in Revelation, I think it's kind of interesting that Judah is the first one mentioned. He, you know, because Judah is really the tribe of promise. Okay, that's where David came from. That's where Christ came from. Okay, Reuben, you have Judah in this list here. Okay, read on down through there, and we're gonna. The next one you have is the Levites. Okay. He gives a lot of big measurements and stuff there. Why he does that for the Levites and why he does it for Judah, I have no idea. Okay. Next one you have after the Levites and the long talk about the Levites and stuff, which the Levites were not given a portion of land, were they? What were they given? Cities throughout the land. Okay. Next one would be Benjamin, then Simeon, and Issachar, and then Zebulun, right? Then Gad, and there you have it. How many do you have?
I hope somebody was counting.
You should have more than 12.
13.
You should have, without counting Levi. Okay. You would have 12. Okay. Because again, the Levites were not given a portion of land. Everything is as it should be. That's what I want you to get. The tribe of Levi is throughout the whole land. Okay? All right, verse 30. It says, these are the exits of the city on the north, measuring 4,500 cubits. The gates shall be named after the tribes of Israel. So there will be 12 gates, and they'll be named after the 12 tribes of Israel. Okay? And it goes right down the list here, and it gives you the names of those tribes again. Okay? So three gates on the north, Reuben, Judah, and Levi. Those are three on the, all right? Three gates on the east side, Joseph, Benjamin, and Dan. Now, what you're noticing here is Manasseh and Ephraim are not here. It's Joseph. It is the 12 sons. Okay? On the south side, Simeon, Issachar, and Zebulun. And then on the west side, finally you have Gad, Asher, and Naphtali. And then it says, all the way around shall be 18,000 cubits, and the name of the city from that day shall be the Lord is there. Which we say Yahweh Shema. Okay? Yahweh, or some people say Jehovah. Yahweh, Jehovah, Shema. The Lord is there. Okay? So, this is the millennial city. Where will the Lord rule and reign from? From that city. Okay? What will be taking place in that city? Everything God intended to be taking place by His people from the very beginning, which includes the temple worship, the offerings that were given in the temple, the offerings given to God, the sacrifices of the people given to God from a right heart. Okay? They will not have an earthly king. They will have Messiah as their king. And they will be the light of the nations for 1,000 years. The light of the nations for 1,000 years. And they will be a welcoming land. And they will treat foreigners not in a hostile way, but they will treat foreigners in a very welcoming way, as we just read, even to the place where they might come and have children there and gain part of the inheritance. And it will not be a selfish time. It will be a time of sharing. It will be a time of openness. Nothing like the world has ever known. Because even today, everything within us says, think about this, on a national level and many times on a personal level, everything in us says, this is mine. This is my America. Don't you come in unless I let you come in. This is my house. This is my fenced yard. You know, we have to have our space. So we have learned to be very possessive of something, and we've learned to exclude people. And sometimes our exclusion of people, I want you to think, sometimes our exclusion of people is not based on anything except for our prejudice against them. And we have, because we don't judge righteously. And we have to admit that. But in this day, the righteous judge will be there. And everything will be as it should be. That's the message of hope as Ezekiel closes, because as you remember, we've seen a lot of messages that didn't seem to give a whole lot of hope as we've gone through here. I guess you could just say, when it's all said and done, everything will be, God promises again through His prophet that everything will be exactly as God intended for it to be. And nobody can change God's plan. You know, the devil tries, you know. And I want to remind you as we close this out, who's in the very center of God's plan? What people are in the very center of God's plan? So be very careful of these theologians in the church today that are replacement theologians that say God has no use for the nation of Israel any longer. The Jews have no place in God's plan, that the church has become the new Israel. No, we haven't. Be careful of those who say that you are a spiritual Jew. No, you're not. No, you're not. You're a born-again Christian. That's what you are. You're not a spiritual Jew when you became a Christian. Okay? We use all these things because you say, well, isn't Abraham our father in a spiritual sense? Yes, he is. Yes, he is in that sense. But that doesn't make you Jewish. You know? But again, when we think about the one of the messages of the church, which a lot of people are offended by, the message that I continually say is, that we pray for Israel, we support Israel, we love Israel. And I've told you so many times, that doesn't mean we agree with everything that the Israeli government does and every decision that they make. It doesn't even mean that we, when they do something that's contrary to decent things, that we don't say, hey, guys. But there's a dangerous teaching that says, that's very close to some of the Islamic teaching, that they will destroy Israel. But remember, Islam wasn't the first people who said they would do this. Satan has tried this over and over again. Anybody remember a guy by the name of Mordecai? Okay. He was not Islamic. Anybody remember a man by the name of Adolf Hitler? He wasn't Islamic. Matter of fact, he used a lot the organized church at that time to do his dirty work. Okay? And now the next group that's coming along is Islam. With the same thing, intent of Mordecai and the same intent of Adolf Hitler. And isn't it interesting that their intent is to destroy this little nation? Who cares?
Mordecai.
Oh, Esther.
Haman,
I'm sorry. You're right. Thank you. Thank you. Haman, you're right. Mordecai was the uncle of Esther.
We cheer Mordecai.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, what's that celebration?
Purim.
We were in Israel one time when they had Purim celebration. It was a gas. We had a good time. Yes, thank you. It's Haman. Okay, thanks for clarifying that. Why, even in that time, did the Jews hold any real threat against the Persian Empire? None.
It was all pride.
Yeah, and in the time of Adolf Hitler, did the Jews really hold any threat to Germany?
No.
And in today, in comparison to all the Islamic countries that surround Israel, I mean, does Israel offer any threat? Israel hasn't attacked any of those nations.
Yeah, they aren't trying to take over anybody.
No.
So why do all these people have such an intense hate for the Jewish people? Why do they want to destroy them? It's much more than any political thing. There's nothing in Israel that would cause you to want to destroy them. They have no oil. They have nothing. It's just a little strip of land there on the Mediterranean Sea. And there, by the way, you can go, I don't want to say really south of it, but you can go north of it and find better strips of land on the Mediterranean Sea. Okay, there's a spiritual thing going on because these are God's covenant people, and God's enemy hates Israel. And by the way, it really breaks my heart to think that hatred has found its way into the church. With so many, the church has a history of anti-Semitism, and again, I think the latest round of that is this replacement theology that's come in to say Israel. It doesn't matter if Israel exists or not. Of course it's not. But that becomes a problem within the church where men want what they want and they create their own doctrines. Yeah.
I think the people like Hitler and on and on, they're satanic and Satan hates the Jews because it's a God's chosen people.
Well, sure. Because I think it's an act of futility. I hope we understand that. But Satan wants to destroy them. If Satan could destroy Israel, then God's covenant, as we just saw, will not be fulfilled.
Right.
And if Satan can make God a liar, then everything falls apart. Mm-hmm. He won't be able to.
No.
But
how many years has it been that the Muslims have come into the forefront?
Okay, the Muslim people. I mean, Muhammad is around 600 A.D. And as I told the people on Sunday night, is that the Muslim faith is newer than Judaism for sure, and actually newer than the Christian faith. Muhammad came along and supposedly had visions, okay, because the Arab people were polytheistic at that time. They worshiped many gods. And Muhammad said that God spoke to him and told him, Allah spoke to him and told him through his angel, Gabriel, that he needed to pull the people back together. And I mean, they fought each other for a long time over this matter of polytheism and monotheism. And the branch of monotheistic religion, that is, Allah is the one and only God, they won out. Okay? Muhammad wrote the Quran. You have all of this, all these battles that went on, even within the Arab nations to do this. Muhammad's brand of Islam was not accepted very well among the Arab nations at first. But most of them have been converted by power,
right,
by strength. Okay? So you have this great battle that's going on and stuff. So when they tell you that their faith, the Islamic faith, goes all the way back to Ishmael, there is no proof to that at all.
Like ours going back to Jonathan.
Well, yeah. But
there are some Baptists.
But yeah, well, there's some Baptists that are nuts. So it's a false claim. It's revisionist history. It just doesn't exist. So if you look at our Bible takes us back, you know, and it's been there all the time. Stuff that's not true of Islam. The Quran is a new book. The Quran is not an ancient book. It's a new book. So,
isn't that something, though, when you think that we've always been taught through the years, I mean, me being an old lady, Russia and China are the two main factors that we're going to deal with and everything. Then all of a sudden the Muslims come.
Well, think about it. That's because what we have a tendency to do in the Western church is put ourselves at the center of everything. Who did we hate for years? We hated the communists. And so the communists, you know, became the Antichrist to us. Okay? And I think we're always, when a people do that, even a religious group, when we put ourselves at the center of everything, then we start reading prophecy. That's why I keep pointing to you over and over again that the center of God's plan for prophecy, if you want to deal with a people group, is always Israel. It's not the church. The church is absent from prophecy. In the prophetic books, I challenge you to find me in the church. You say, well, Revelation. Well, Revelation, again, actually, Revelation does not begin with the first three chapters of Revelation are not prophetic books at all. The prophecy in Revelation doesn't start till about the fourth chapter. So, but I think that's what we do. So they're our enemies, so they're the great Satan to us, so, you know. By the way, other groups do that too. To Islam, the great Satan is the United States. Little Satan is Israel. Okay? So their task is to destroy the great Satan, the infidels. Our country is filled with infidels. And in the last 10 years, I know if your eyes have been open, you've seen the influence of Islam that was not here 10 years ago.
Sneaking in.
10 years ago, I would dare say none of you knew anything about the fasting time called Ramadan. It wasn't even on your radar screen. Okay? When you talk about Sharia law, which in some communities in America is already being enacted, that wasn't on your screen. The Quran. A lot of Christians, most Christians 10 years ago never even heard of the Quran. And when they thought about Islamic people, they thought of Arabs that are descendants of Ishmael and those groups and stuff like that who weren't Jewish and weren't Christian. They were just, you know, things have changed very quickly and very rapidly. Okay? Yes?
And I know we don't want to get political, but just Ramadan was celebrated last night at the White House.
They've been doing that through the years.
And they also they have listed out of the woman who works with Hillary Clinton, who whose family has ties with the Muslim
Brotherhood. Yeah, it's a whole different world. It's a whole different world. We are living in these times, mm-hmm. and let me just throw this out to you. When we talk about prophecy, there's another huge group of people that are not even mentioned in prophecy. yet we think that the world revolves around us. The United States is not even inferred.
Right.
Someone tries to infer, that's exactly what they're doing, because it's not even there. Can you imagine worldwide events happening without the impact of the United States of America? And what could possibly have happened that this great big nation that the world for 200 years, everything's been about us. Our dollar is the currency of the world. I mean, we go right on down the line. And then when we come to prophecy, this big powerful nation is not even... Russia's talked about. Iran's talked about. Rome has talked about. Babylon's talked about. Sunny.
I have a question, but maybe you know what we do such a good job of spreading the word that we're in a rapture, so we're
not going to... Well, I believe that's going to be part of it. I do. I think the rapture could be the thing that will cause this country to implode. So,
yes. Mm-hmm.
But go ahead.
I just want to be clear. When you're saying the millennium...
Yes.
And you said that God is going to be the ruler over all the other nations.
The Lord, yes. Jesus. Mm-hmm.
So there are, because it seems like we have this center where we keep focusing on this, but all these other countries are going to exist.
Yep. The earth will still be here. The nations will still be here. A lot of them will have been destroyed, but then you're going to have the world being changed, and it'll populate itself again.
But it's just amazing because obviously, even with all this destruction, we're going to know that God is here and He's going to rule and reign, and we're not going to have all these other rulers.
Right.
We're going to still have the technology to be aware of what He would like His people to do.
Yeah. Very interesting.
So then you have what you were talking about here in the Bible where they were saying there's going to be these different priests. So maybe that's part of where the 144,000 are basically out there sharing the word to these outer nations. Or are they supposed to still have their...
No, the 144,000, their work is during the 144,000, their work is during the tribulation. Mm-hmm. Not during the millennium. They're done. Christ will be the center of everything. And the world will revere Him as, we'd say, ruler or world leader from our perspective of that. And for 1,000 years, the world will know peace. I mean, real peace.
But it also mentioned in here, too, I mean, where it was talking about how there's this section for all of the priests.
There's what? But that section's within the land, among Israel, not the world.
I guess it just seems like if God is that close, you'd be surprised that you would still need these priests. So that's why I was just wondering as far as these outer nations.
Yeah, but I think, I would agree with you. The priests, I would even think that the priest function would be different. And I don't know, it doesn't describe how it would be different. Because they're not going to have to go, remember the Old Testament, people would go through the priest to the Lord. They won't have to do that.
Right, and there's but the sacrifice anymore. There's not going to
right.
be all these things. So that's why it's just...
Yeah, it'll be a transformation, but I don't think it tells us how. Okay. I have to go to appointment, so let me pray with you, and I'm going to have to run.